You are now listening to Jess is Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Jess is Lit. It is a gloomy morning here in Vancouver, British Columbia. I did mention last episode that I will be starting at 2 o'clock to 3 every Wednesdays, but that has changed due to my personal schedule changes and conflicts. And so I will be starting my show on every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. And so that will just be my schedule for the meantime. Today is also an exciting day. I did kind of try to make up some topics for today. I was originally planning on just playing music, just to kind of get used to the cold and rainy weather of Vancouver, but I came across another short story that I'm not sure if I can, you know what, if we do kind of speed up, we might be able to get through it today. If not, we'll just kind of section it off and finish it in my next episode. But the story I'll be reading today is a very famous one. It's from Ursula K. Le Guin, and it's called The Ones Who Walk Away from Amelas. Now, this is also a very interesting story. I would say it, in a sense, creates more discussion than The Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka, just through my experience with reading this as a class and on my own and with peers and just by myself. It creates more of a, I would say more of a, it can create a heated discussion, and there is a dichotomy, I should say, with different notions and opinions with different people who read them. And so we'll give this one a read. I guess it would be more of a one or two episode thing instead of a whole series like The Metamorphosis, but I decided this one would be appropriate and interesting to go over with you guys. In between the readings, of course, I will play some tunes. I've chosen several, and so we'll just see how the time goes, and then I'll play some in between the readings. But before we start on the readings, we'll play some ads, PSAs, and some show promos. And so I'll be right back after this. Here we go.
Are you interested in being advertised in Discorder Magazine? Discorder Magazine can be found in 32 locations and counting across Vancouver from UBC to New Westminster. You could be featured in cultural and community hubs across the Lower Mainland. To find out how you can be featured in Discorder Magazine, contact advertising@citr.ca, advertising@citr.ca. Rates start at $150. Ride with Discorder Magazine and we'll take you all the way.
Welcome to Lethal Refresh.
I'm Danny.
I'm B.
I'm Sta.
I'm Jay.
Let's get lethal. Let's get refreshed. When it's darkest, we always attract the brightest people.
Baby, you a light. Shift my whole world to the right. Please listen to Lethal Refresh on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Nardor de Human Serviette and doo 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 doo.
Doo doo. Thank you!
Lethal Refresh, every Monday, 12 to 1 p.m. New music every week.
Re-20-20. Catch up, that one. I the east side. Rocking in a little tight. Yeah.
Royal Otis, live in concert. Coming to the PNE Forum in Vancouver on October 22nd. Fresh off the heels of their debut album, Prats in Pain, and the viral cover of Murder on the Dance Floor for Triple J's Like a Virgin, don't miss the Australian duo on their biggest tour yet, Royal Otis, Glory to Glory Fall Tour. Tickets are on sale now at ticketleader.ca. TicketLeader.ca. Knock, knock. Guess who? MRG Live coming right back at you, this time with a whole new list of upcoming live shows by your favorite artists. Hear this: Marika Hackman, Faye Webster, Empress of, Peter Cat Recording Co., and The Rare Occasions are a few of the artists MRG Live is bringing to you. Follow at MRG Live Official on Instagram to stay tuned with all the artists performing near you.
Welcome back to Jess is Lit. Those were some ads, show promos, and PSAs. Now, without wasting more time, we will get right into the readings. I'm very excited to go along with this this little journey with you guys. I did read this a couple years ago, and I found myself really enjoying it, and I am just as excited right now than when I was for the first time, and so we'll go right into it. With the clamor of bells that set the swallows soaring, the festival of summer came to the city Amalas, bright towered by the sea. The rigging of the boats in harbor sparkled with flags. In the streets between houses with red roofs and painted walls, between old moss-grown gardens and under avenues of trees, past great parks and public buildings, processions moved. Some were decorous, old people in long, stiff robes of mauve and gray, grave master workmen, quiet, merry women carrying their babies and chatting as they walked. In other streets, the music beat faster. A shimmering of gong and tambourine, and the people went dancing. The procession was a dance. Children dodged in and out, their high calls rising like the shallows crossing flights over the music and the singing. All the processions would wound towards the north side of the city, where on the great water meadow called the Green Fields, boys and girls, naked in their bright air, with mud-stained feet and ankles and long, lithe arms, exercised their restive horses before the race. The horses wore no gear at all, but a halter without bit. Their manes were braided with streamers of silver, gold, and green. They flared their nostrils and pranced and boasted to one another. They were vastly excited, the horse being the only animal who has adopted our ceremonies as his own. Far off to the north and west, the mountains stood up half-encircling Amalas on her bay. The air of morning was so clear that the snow still crowning the 18 peaks burned with white gold fire across the miles of sunlit air under the dark blue of the sky. There was just enough wind to make the banners that marked the race course snap and flutter now and then. In the silence of the broad green meadows, one could hear the music winding through the city streets, farther and nearer and ever approaching. A cheerful, faint sweetness of the air that from time to time trembled and gathered together and broke out into a great joyous clanging of the bells. Joyous! How is one to tell about joy? How describe the citizens of Omelus? They were not simple folk, you see, though they were happy. But we do not say the words of cheer much any more. All smiles have become archaic. Given a description such as this one, tends to make certain assumptions. Given a description such as this one, tends to look next for the king, mounted on a splendid stallion and surrounded by its noble knights, or perhaps in a golden litter borne by great muscled slaves. But there was no king. They did not use swords or keep slaves. They were not barbarians. I do not know the rules and laws of their society, but I suspect that they were singularly few. As they did without monarchy and slavery, so they also got on without the stock exchange, the advertisement, the secret police, and the bomb. Yet I repeat that these were not simple folk, not dulcet shepherds, noble savages, bland utopians. They were not less complex than us. The trouble is that we have a bad habit, encouraged by pedants, and sophisticates, of considering happiness as something rather stupid. Only pain is intellectual, only evil interesting. This is the treason of the artist, a refusal to admit the banality of evil and the terrible boredom of pain. If you can't lick him, join him. If it hurts, repeat it. But to praise despair is to condemn delight. To embrace violence is to lose hold of everything else. We have almost lost hold. We can no longer describe a happy man, nor make any celebration of joy. How can I tell you about the people of Omelus? They were not naive and happy children, though their children were, in fact, happy. They were mature, intelligent, passionate adults whose lives were not wretched. Oh, miracle! But I wish I could describe it better. I wish I could convince you. Omelus sounds, in my words, like a city in a fairy tale. Long ago and far away, once upon a time. Perhaps it would be best if you imagined it as your own fancy bids, assuming it will rise to the occasion. For certainly I cannot suit you all. For instance, how about technology? I think that there would be no cars or helicopters in and above the streets. This follows from the fact that the people of Omelus are happy people. Happiness is based on just discrimination of what is necessary, what is either necessary nor destructive, and what is destructive. In the middle category, however, that of the unnecessary but undestructive, that of comfort, luxury, exuberance, etc., they could perfectly well have central heating, subway trains, washing machines, and all kinds of marvelous devices not yet invented here, floating light sources, fuelless power, a cure for the common cold. Or they could have none of that. It doesn't matter. As you like it. I incline to think that people from towns up and down the coast have been coming into Omelus during the last days before the festival on very fast little trains and double-decked trams, and that the train station of Omelus is actually the handsomest building in town, though plainer than the magnificent farmer's market. But even granted trains, I fear that Omelus so far strikes some of you as goody-goody. Smiles, bells, parades, horses, bleh. If so, please add an orgy. If an orgy would help, don't hesitate. Let us not, however, have temples from which issue beautiful nude priests and priestesses already half in ecstasy and ready to copulate with any man or woman, lover or stranger who desires union with the deep godhead of the blood, although that was my first idea. But really, it would be better not to have any temples in Omela. At least, not manned temples. Religion, yes. Clergy, no. Surely the beautiful nudes can just wander about, offering themselves like divine souffles to the hungry, to the hunger of the needy and the rapture of the flesh. Let them join the processions. Let tambourines be struck above the copulations, and the glory of desire be proclaimed upon the gongs, and, a not unimportant point, let the offspring of these delightful rituals be beloved and looked after by all. One thing I know there is none of in Amelas is guilt. But what else should there be? I thought at first there were no drugs, but that is puritanical. For those who like it, the faint insistent sweetness of druze may perfume the ways of the city. Druze, which first brings a great lightness and brilliance to the minds and limbs, and then after some hours a dreamy languor, and wonderful visions at last of the very arcana and inmost secrets of the universe, as well as exciting the pleasure of sex beyond all belief. And it is not habit-forming. For more modest tastes, I think there ought to be beer. What else? What else belongs in the joyous city? The sense of victory, surely, the celebration of courage. But as we did without clergy, let us do without soldiers. The joy built upon successful slaughter is not the right kind of joy. It will not do. It is fearful and it is trivial. A boundless and generous contentment, a magnanimous triumph felt not against some outer enemy, but in communion with the finest and fairest in the souls of all men, everywhere, and the splendor of the world's summer. This is what swells the hearts of the people of Amelas, and the victory they celebrate is that of life. I really don't think many of them need to take druze. Most of the processions have reached the green fields by now. A marvelous smell of cooking goes forth from the red and blue tents of the provisioners. The faces of small children are amiably sticky. In the benign gray beard of a man, a couple of crumbs of rich pastry are entangled. The youths and girls have mounted their horses and are beginning to group around the starting line of the course. An old woman, small, fat, and laughing, is passing out flowers from a basket, and tall young men wear her flowers and their shining hair. A child of 9 or 10 sits at the edge of the crowd, alone, playing on a wooden flute. People pause to listen, and they smile, but they do not speak to him, for he never ceases playing and never sees them, his dark eyes wholly wrapped in the sweet, thin magic of the tune. He finishes, and slowly lowers his hands, holding the wooden flute. As if that little private silence were the signal, all at once a trumpet sounds from the pavilion near the starting line, imperious, melancholy, piercing. The horses rear on their slender legs, and some of them neigh in answer. Sober-faced, the young riders stroke the horses' necks and soothe them, whispering, "Quiet, quiet, there, my beauty, my hope." They begin to form in rank along the starting line. The crowds along the race course are like a field of grass and flowers in the wind. The festival of summer has begun. Do you believe? Do you accept the festival, the city, and the joy? No? Then let me describe one more thing. Now we will stop right there before it gets more interesting. So now basically what's happening is the narrator is describing the city of Amelas, and right now it seems to be a perfect example of a utopia, just a perfect world where happiness flourishes, people have no guilt, people have their needs and their desires met, and it just seems like a perfect world for now. But as you guys heard the last sentence, then let me describe one more thing. Wait until we figure it out. We'll play one song. It's called This Song Sucks. I know it's an ironic title by Jade Turner. So we'll be right back after this.
This song sucks. I used to play it on repeat. Back when it was you and me, had a pretty little shiny ring. This song sucks, used to get me in the feels.
We are back. That was This Song Sucks by Jay Turner. Now we'll get right into the readings. In a basement, under one of the most beautiful public buildings of Omelas, or perhaps in the cellar of one of its spacious private homes, there is a room. It has one locked door and no window. A little light seeps in dustily between cracks in the boards, secondhand from a cobwebbed window somewhere across the cellar. In one corner of the little room, a couple of mops with stiff, clotted, foul-smelling heads stand near a rusty bucket. The floor is dirt, a little damp to the touch, as cellar dirt usually is. The room is about 3 paces long and 2 wide, a mere broom closet, disused tool room. In the room, a child is sitting. It could be a boy or a girl. It looks about 6, but actually is nearly 10. It is feeble-minded. Perhaps it was born defective, or perhaps it has become imbecile through fear, malnutrition, and neglect. It picks its nose and occasionally fumbles vaguely with its toes or genitals as it sits hunched in the corner farthest from the bucket and the 2 mops. It is afraid of the mops. It finds them horrible. It shuts its eyes, but it knows the mops are still standing there, and the door is locked and nobody will come. The door is always locked and nobody ever comes, except that sometimes the child has no understanding of time or interval. Sometimes the door rattles terribly and opens, and a person or several people are there. One of them may come and kick the child to make it stand up. The others never come close, but peer in at it with frightened, disgusted eyes. The food bowl and the water jug are hastily filled. The door is locked. The eyes disappear. The people at the door never say anything, but the child, who has not always lived in the tool room and can remember sunlight and its mother's voice, sometimes speaks, "I will be good," it says. "Please let me out. I will be good." They never answer. The child used to scream for help at night and cry a good deal, but now it only makes a kind of whining. "Ee-ha, ee-ha." And it speaks less and less often. It is so thin that there are no calves to its legs. Its belly protrudes. It lives on a half bowl of cornmeal and grease a day. And it's naked. Its buttocks and thighs are a mass of festered sores as it sits in its own excrement continually. They all know it is there, all the people of Omelas. Some of them have come to see it. Others are content merely to know it is there. They all know that it has to be there. Some of them understand why, and some do not. But they all understand that their happiness, the beauty of their city, the tenderness of their friendships, the health of their children, the wisdom of their scholars, the skills of their makers, even the abundance of their harvest and the kindly weathers of the skies, depend wholly on this child's abominable misery. This is usually explained to children when they are about between 8 and 12, whenever they seem capable of understanding. And most of those who come to see the child are young people, though often enough an adult comes or comes back to see the child. No matter how well the matter has been explained to them, these young spectators are always shocked and sickened at the sight. They feel disgust, which they had thought themselves superior to. They feel anger, outrage, impotence, despite all the explanations. They would like to do something for the child, but there is nothing they can do. If the child were brought up into the sunlight, out of that vile place, if it were cleaned and fed and comforted, that would be a good thing indeed. But if it were done, in that day and hour, all the prosperity and beauty and delight of Omelas would wither and be destroyed. Those are the terms. To exchange all the goodness and grace of every life in Omelas for that single, small improvement. To throw away the happiness of thousands for the chance of the happiness of one. That would be to let guilt within the walls indeed. The terms are strict and absolute. There may not even be a kind word spoken to the child, often the young people go home in tears, or in a tearless rage, when they have seen the child and faced its terrible paradox. They may brood over it for weeks or years, but as time goes on, they begin to realize that even if the child could be released, it would not get much good of its freedom. A little vague pleasure of warmth and food, no doubt, but little more. It is too degraded and imbecile to know any real joy. It has been afraid too long ever to be free of fear. Its habits are too uncouth for it to respond to humane treatment. Indeed, after all, so long it would probably be wretched without walls about it to protect it, and darkness for its eyes and its own excrement to sit in. Their tears at the bitter injustice dry when they begin to perceive the terrible justice of reality and to accept it. Yet it is their tears and anger, the trying of their generosity and the acceptance of their helplessness, which are perhaps the true source of the splendor of their lives. There is no vapid, irresponsible happiness. They know that they, like the child, are not free. They know compassion. It is the existence of the child, and their knowledge of its existence that makes possible the nobility of their architecture, the poignancy of their music, the profundity of their science. It is because of the child that they are so gentle with children. They know that if the wretched one were not there, sniveling in the dark, the other one, the flute player, could make no joyful music as the young riders line up in their beauty for the race in the sunlight of the first morning of summer. Now do you believe in them? Are they not more credible? But there is one more thing to tell, and this is quite incredible. Now we'll take another quick break. That was a quick turn in vibes, I guess. It turned out to be a very... Well, it started off as a very beautiful world, but as we uncover the deep secrets, there lies a very dark, dark, dark situation. And that was a child. And the child, a human, is perceived as it. And that, I think, is definitely purposely done by the narrator to give us a deeper sense of how the child is portrayed in the world of Omelus. And it is just deeply saddening to hear about the child's life. But again, that's just how the world is in Omelus. And if the child is saved, Omelus crumbles, vice versa. And so it is a very complicated subject to kind of deal with, but we will get right back into... I think we'll be able to finish up the whole reading quite quickly, actually. We just have one medium-length paragraph left, and then I guess we'll just talk about this on our own after this. But we'll be back after a quick song. It's called Deadweight by Jade Turner, so we'll be right back. Here we go.
Turn off the voices. that just dead away. Feeling I'm not good enough, that shit is real tough. I don't like feeling this way. Looking at the big screen, but I don't see me. Something's gotta change. Whatever the cost is, gonna cut my losses. Get right back to being me. Turn off the voices, make my own choices of who. Just dead weight. Whatever the cost is, gonna cut my losses. Get right back to being me.
That was Dead Weight by Jade Turner. Now we just have a paragraph to read, and so we'll finish off the story. Now, do you believe in them? Are they not more credible? But there is one more thing to tell you, and this is quite incredible. At times, one of the adolescent girls or boys who go to see the child does not go home to weep or rage, does not in fact go home at all. Sometimes also a man or woman much older falls silent for a day or two and then leaves home. These people go out into the street and walk down the street alone. They keep walking and walk straight out of the city of Amelis through the beautiful gates. They keep walking across the farmlands of Amelis. Each one goes alone, youth or girl, man or woman. Night falls. The traveler must pass down village streets between the houses with yellow-lit windows, and on out into the darkness of the fields. Each alone, they go west or north towards the mountains. They go on. They leave Amelis. They walk ahead into the darkness, and they do not come back. The place they go towards is a place even less imaginable to most of us than the City of Happiness. I cannot describe it at all. It is possible that it does not exist, but they seem to know where they are going, the ones who walk away from Amelis. Now that was the finishing of The Ones Who Walk Away from Amelis. Let's give us a round of applause. It was a very fun book. A lot of people like this better than The Metamorphosis. In my opinion, I prefer this over The Metamorphosis just because it just creates more of an intense vibe with one after finishing. And I hope you guys understand why at first I said it creates more discussion, because you're left with two choices, and the two choices are just very explicitly but also implicitly conveyed throughout the story. The narrator explains in detail about the most beautiful city, and that is Amelis, where happiness flourishes, where guilt is not existing, where people meet their desires and wants freely. They are happy. They are just full of excitement and positivity. Yet, as we keep reading, that comes with a cost. And in order for the city of Omelis to keep thriving on positivity and happiness, there has to be a child inside a basement cave, or a jail cell, so to speak. And the child is in deep suffering and is just completely the opposite of what the world was or is. And in order for the world to flourish, of course, the child needs to suffer. And you could see it very in a deeper sense when even the narrator explains the child as an it. It's not even considered a human. And so that needs to be there in order for the world to exist. And the world can only exist if that is there. I know it's a little bit of a wordplay, but that's basically what it is. And in the last paragraph, it moves on and says that, okay, well, partly in the second paragraph too, people are able to see the child. And they have mixed emotions. Some people are fine, some people are not. But they can't do anything about it because doing something would cost the whole city's lives and the whole city. And so it doesn't necessarily say, but for me at least, I could sense fear in the people when they see the child. And at least for the people who are not okay with it, it's fear that, if I do end up helping this child, everyone in the city is going to die and perish. And so this mixed emotional, I guess, sense of morality comes into play here. And just the notion of good or bad comes in as well, of course. And it's just fear that, you know, if I do this, this will happen, the consequences. And so people don't really do anything about it. Now, if you progress on to the last paragraph, then it kind of plays out differently. Now, for the people who obviously are okay with it, they stay, but the narrator mentions that, you know, people like kids or adults or old people, the people who are not okay with this are deciding to leave the city. And the funny thing is that they don't even know what leaving the city means. They don't know what's going to be out there. They don't know. Again, it's called the darkness. Into the darkness, and they don't come back. And to quote, the place they go towards is a place even less imaginable to most of us than the city of happiness. So they don't even know what this place is outside of the city Omelis, but they still choose to get out because they just do not like how the city of Omelis operates. And so the story is very philosophical in that sense. It really gets you to think of the importance of the collective and the individual, and really makes you think about the contrast between the individual and the collective. And it's a really interesting story. The citizens, the people who live there, they're not able to change the structure that requires the child to suffer for the city's happiness. And the city can choose to disengage with Omelis by leaving it. And leaving Omelis is very much the ultimate act of individualism, because obviously it requires one to reject the current comfort and situation of a society, and a stand for one's own sense of morality. And so because you value your sense of morality more than the collective of a society, you decide to act on the ultimate stance of individualism. Now, the narrator doesn't really necessarily say whether walking away from Omelis is right or wrong. So again, here, this whole story is not about what is right or wrong. That's the thing. But the narrator asks the audience, basically asks us who read this, to reflect on the limits of our own ability, and also to imagine a city that is not like Omelas. It is impossible for us to fully know whether, you know, the city that lies ahead of Omelas is good or bad, or to imagine a society at all that has unjust suffering. But it does, in a sense, create this moral compass and allows us to think in a more open-minded way and to trust our morals more freely than I guess from the past. Now, that is basically all I can say here. It really gets us readers to reflect on ourselves and the place we live in. And the narrator also suggests that you know, one can and cannot imagine is always deeply reflective of one's own reality. Now, the reality we live in creates our own morals, or our morals is deeply influenced by the reality we are in. And so my morals could be significantly different from another person's morals in a different reality. And I also think that the narrator is coming to us with this statement, saying that it is impossible for the reader, so it's impossible for us, to imagine a truly happy society. Now, this also reflects on our own societal experiences, but it makes us question, would there ever be a society with unjust happiness, or is unjust happiness a requirement for a society to function? Because, as they mentioned, if the child was saved, Omelas would go into complete catastrophe and just would crumble down into bits. And so that was very interesting. But yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed the story. It is a very deep story in its sense. I hope it got you guys to reflect on the realities of your lives and your own reality in an individual sense. And to me, I think it's really important to think in both ways, think with the collective mindset and the individualistic mindset. And I think the story really hits deeply with a lot of people and can be reached towards a much broader audience, I think to any audience. And Ursula K. Le Guin is a really, really cool writer. I haven't read much of her work, but this story is by far my favorite from her. And so we'll definitely try and bring some more songs, or not songs, more stories from her in the future. But I hope you guys enjoyed this story, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. Now, if you guys have any more recommendations on short stories, or could be medium length as well, we could do like a longer series, please feel free to let me know. I will be most happy to go over these with you guys. And so we will end off the story there and the analysis. It was a quick analysis, but we kind of went over the bigger picture. But we'll finish off the story from here. And before we end off the episode, I have one more song. It is called Our Home by Curtis Clear Sky and the Constellations with a Z or Z. So we'll finish this off and then end the show. So we'll hear this. Our Home by Curtis Clear Sky and the Constellations. Here we go.
Connected to my soul, you are strong, so powerful. get our land back. This is where we've been, at the battle goes way back. Genocidal attacks, kicking these real facts. Come on, baby, with that knowledge and the wisdom. My people been living in a prison reservation system since the beginning of the land and arrival. We've been in survival. It's time for the healing. It's time for the dealing of the loss of our land. Are you taking a stand? Taking no exceptions. We're deep in protection of what we got left. We're gonna fight to the last breath. My people paid the cost. My people seen the loss. You haven't heard it all. Hear it in the raw. There is no mystery to the hidden history. The rat'll keep us blissfully ignorant. Hey, I'm here to represent. The love for world is the love for land. Know you are blessed, never selfless. Shoot for the best, overcome stress. Take a deep breath, never acquiesce. In each and every step, we're making progress. The truth and the test is the attempt to divide us. Set in the sirens, the hate is a virus. System is lying, addicted, I'm dying. Struggle and striving, never stay silent. Always unite in the dark and the light. That keeps on striking, striking and striking like you are lightning. Keep on fighting, fighting and fighting until we are thriving.
Our Home by Curtis Clear Sky and the Constellations. Now we'll wrap up today's show with that. Today we just went over The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas by Ursula K. Le Guin, and we listened to a couple of songs. Thank you guys for joining in. I will see you guys again next week with another episode. I'm not sure what we're going to do, but it'll be a surprise. Have yourselves a great rest of the day, and I hope to come to me with more recommendations. But if not, I'll just do my own stuff, and probably might bring some songs in, not quite sure, but we'll see how next week goes. But anyways, have yourselves a good rest of the day and week, and I'll see you soon. Thank you all. Bye-bye.